Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, everyone. This is Chad. I've had the pleasure of interviewing people in all types of roles that can help product managers, developers, and innovators. And today, I get to bring you a discussion with the chairman of the Product Development and Management Association, PDMA, who is Charlie Noble. I've been wanting to do this interview because PDMA is the professional association that really opened my eyes to the discipline of product management. Charlie is also an award-winning professor at the University of Tennessee, where he teaches design, innovation, and new product development. He has helped many organizations with product development and marketing issues, as well as contributing to research in these areas. Charlie, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Chad. It's great to be here.
I thought we'd structure this interview in kind of two parts. First, I want to learn about you and your insights that you've made about innovation, and then talk specifically about PDMA as an association and your work with PDMA. Does that sound like a good plan?
Sounds great.
Cool. So I'm going to take you back a few years here. I saw when you were an undergrad at Boston College that you were involved with the student group that founded 12 businesses. I thought, wow, what rich experience as a college student to be starting businesses. How did those experiences shape your view of business and the innovation work you do?
Oh, wow. That's an interesting tidbit that you've latched onto there. I haven't talked about that in a long time. But I was one of the founding members of an organization called BC Student Agencies, which, as far as I know, is still going strong today. And the idea was to be an incubator for student entrepreneurship, with just a minimal level of university support. We really had no working capital at all, just some office space and things like that. And so it was this great breeding ground where we could just get together and brainstorm and come up with all sorts of things. And in the course of my time there, I was able to start four different businesses, which probably accounted for at least a tenth or two of GPA each in reduction, because I was spending all that time. But it was worth it, I think.
I would trade the experience for the GPA, I think.
All right, good. I should have had you talk to my parents back in the day. But it was great. It was a great time and a great experience. In terms of innovation, you know, we started different things. Most of them we're probably more service oriented, but you know, I think service innovation is a very much kind of under focused field. So I still certainly consider that innovation work. You know, a lot of in terms of insights or what I learned, I think, you know, looking for holes in what customers want and need, looking for shortcomings and what they're getting now. The most lucrative and incredibly profitable business that I started was, you know, we had a lot of students at Boston College who were not from the immediate area. A lot were foreign students and from across the country and things like that. And, you know, they would move out of their dorms in May and, you know, would have all these, you know, desk lamps and computers and various things, furniture things and stuff that they needed to put somewhere. And there was really no mechanism to accommodate that. Hmm. And so we invented a business called BC Storage. And I hired a bunch of football players for a week in May, and it was great service. They would go up to people's rooms. We would give them empty boxes, cardboard boxes. We'd kind of like a lower scale pods kind of strategy. Mm-hmm. They'd fill them up. I'd send the football players up there. They'd pull all these things down. We'd put them in a moving truck and put them in storage over the summer. And then reverse the process in the fall. And, you know, I was shocked at how much you could charge for a basic little cardboard moving box, you know, and that kind of service component. And, you know, we made tens of thousands of dollars, you know, it all went back to the university and to the other organizations. But it was great. And so, you know, that was just an example. And students were thrilled, and nobody ever balked at the price and so on, because there was just nothing like it. So, you know, it's just a basic principle of innovation, but just finding those market opportunities, I think, was really critical. It was also, I'm really going to date myself, but it's kind of in the early days of desktop publishing too. And one of the businesses that we had that was most successful was a resume building business where people were doing desktop publishing work on early Macs and things like that, and producing nice resumes for people who otherwise were, you know, sitting in front of a, a typewriter or something and doing it. So, you know, another example of kind of finding that opportunity. So, yeah, so, you know, not the most, the greatest revelation in terms of, you know, the mindset, but it really did, in a way, it did open my eyes too to how easy in some respects it is to find opportunities if you're open-minded enough and observant enough of what's going on around you.
Yeah, exactly. So much of it is just being observant, like you said, looking for those holes in the customer experience for a problem that's not being addressed right now. And those are both industries that continue today, right? So great job providing the storage service and the resume service. So I'm curious if it was those experiences or something else that really fostered your interest in product development and innovation. Where did that begin?
Well, let's see. I was reflecting on that a little bit. I think in truth, it was really an evolution, for me, or a bit of a transition. I guess the short story is I was actually a finance person as an undergraduate and, in the late 1980s. And I graduated in kind of the heyday of real formal strategic management departments and corporations. And so I went to work for a couple of big companies in strategic planning. And so I was making, these really long-term strategic plans. One of them was a company you might know, or folks on the East Coast might know, BJ's Wholesale Club was one that I worked for. And I was making these really long-term plans, you know, 10-year plans and things like that. And I would spend months doing them, and I was the king of the, you know, spreadsheets and all that. And then, you know, I turn in this magnificent thing, and then a month later, management would, you know, sell off half the company or make some radical shift, and my whole beautiful plan would go in the garbage. And so that, you know, got me thinking. And then when I went to do my PhD at Arizona State, which was in the marketing department, you know, you start thinking about dissertation ideas and research ideas. And the first step in my own transition was really thinking more about implementation versus planning. So I was sort of hung up on this idea that, you know, you can make beautiful plans, but if you don't implement them well, then, you know, what difference does it make? And so I sort of played around in that space research-wise. I got to working in my dissertation with a couple of really huge companies, Philip Morris, you know, and cigarette development. I couldn't talk about cigarettes in my dissertation because it was not very politically correct, but it was a consumer packaged goods company. And but I got exposed to innovation and what they were doing. They had some products that really took off, and they had some that really failed. I was working with some really unusual companies, I would say. Like you might know a company called Rural Metro, which is the biggest privatized fire and ambulance provider in the country. They work for where I live now and lots of other communities. And they did some really innovative things that I started to study from an implementation standpoint. Anyway, so I was looking at that. And so the way I look at my evolution is I have sort of started out at the back end of innovation, is the way I think of it, in terms of, you know, implementing ideas and seeing how those play out. And then over the course of my career, I've actually kind of pulled more and more towards the front end. And so, you know, in recent years, I've studied things like open innovation and, you know, wisdom of the crowd sort of things, and real ideation stage stuff, including a big focus on design. So I feel like I've kind of pulled myself backwards through that innovation funnel, which has been really fun and exciting, and kind of enjoyed that trip.
Let's dive into one of those specifically. So you talked about research you did during your dissertation. Since then, you've dived into some of these other areas like open innovation. Have you been involved in either research, or maybe it's even working with companies in a way that really led to some particular interesting findings, some new, you know, personal aha moments that stand out for you?
Yeah, I mean, quite a few, I think. You know, I think they're exciting and interesting. I guess I could talk about a few different things, but maybe I'll tell you about the most recent one that's exciting, that's just really going on still right now. I think a lot of your audience might be familiar with a company called Quirky,
yeah, sure,
which is, you know, a really interesting kind of user innovation, crowd-based innovation platform, whatever you want to call it. You know, for those that don't know the real quick description is, you know, anybody in the world can kick in any sort of back of the napkin idea for an innovative product. They submit it to this online platform, this community, which I guess has surpassed 1 million members, which is pretty amazing. Will come in, they'll critique the idea. Eventually, if it gets over certain hurdles, people will suggest, you know, brand names and taglines and new features and so on and so forth. And for some products, a small percentage, they actually, you know, go to market in the end and are sold either online or through some different retailers. So, and then those that contribute along the way end up with an equity stake in the product and in theory end up getting checks in the mail if the product is a success. So it's a really interesting kind of ecosystem and has been really exciting. So one of the things that I'm interested in now is actually how product development teams, how their job has changed in a world of, you know, open innovation and customer input into the process and things like that. Mm-hmm. So if you think of, you know, the classic way to think about new product development and real front end stuff, you know, it's a team sitting in a conference room with a bunch of sticky notes and hashing things around and playing ping pong when they're bored and things like that. And that, you know, that still goes on, but more and more the process is really changing, you know? So if Doritos runs a competition to find the next Super Bowl ad and they get 30,000 submissions, you know, then it's much more of a sorting process for that product development team than it is a creating or ideating process. So that to me is really interesting and almost suggest that the skill sets of product developers may need to change, you know, as we go forward. So working with a student, it's his dissertation. We're just putting the finishing touches on a study of Quirky. And what he's done is he's found a really interesting data source. Quirky, once a week, has a live streaming video session where they critique half a dozen product ideas or so that are kind of kicking around that have gotten some traction in the organization. And the whole management team, seven or eight people, will be up there at a panel and talking about the pros and cons of these ideas. And they also have an audience of 50 or so people who are employees and friends and other kinds of folks who will comment on these things. And so it's a real great kind of insight into both this incubator or what's going on and then how this management team makes decisions. Mm-hmm. And so, so what we're trying to do is he's taking these videos and he's coding them, and we can turn, you know, video into data by looking for different kinds of comments and different kinds of decisions and things like that. We're trying to look at basically the predictors of a good decision down the road. So what aspects of that process are most likely to lead to them picking the winning product, you know, and avoiding kind of latching onto the dogs and pushing those through into development. And, you know, the results are still kind of being shaped at the moment. They're not super crisp, but it's really been kind of fascinating. I mean, just one little tidbit I would say is that we're finding that management teams, at least this team, is much better at picking winners than in avoiding losers, if that makes sense, right? In other words, they don't pass on too many products that would have been successful otherwise, and we have ways of measuring that. And but they do latch onto a few too many ideas that end up being dogs down the road. And so you know, looking at ways to sort of increase that managerial success rate in new product team decision making is really what we're shooting for there. And I think we've got some good stuff that's going to come out of that. So that's a fun and I think important project.
Yeah, a really interesting study and looking at the management decision-making process. And my understanding of the Quirky model, and for anyone that wants to go find them, I think it's still quirky.com, Q-U-I-R-K-Y. Basically a design studio in New York, and they've crowdsourced the design process. And last time I looked, the kind of the decision-making process came down to 50% of the weight was from the community. So you as an individual can go and participate in the community and vote up ideas, comment on ideas, submit your own ideas. And ultimately, each month in this cycle, you know, half of the decision to go forward with product development or not is left to the community. And the other half is left to the industrial designers, because most of these are physical sort of products, right? The designers and that management team at Quirky. Is that still the same notion?
I think so. Yeah. It used to be, it's probably too much detail, but you know, it used to be they had a specific threshold. I think it was 200 kind of thumbs up from the community. And if you got that many, you would get through the first stage gate and you'd get more personal attention and so on. I believe what happened was there was some shameless gaming that was going on. People were, you know, just sort of asking their friends and family to help them over the hump. And so they've gotten much more black box about it in terms of what gets something, you know, over. But I think it's roughly, you know, that model. I mean, I think one interesting aspect that's changed over the years is when Quirky first started, I believe it was $100. At first they were charging as a fee when you submitted an idea, which, you know, you could argue is a good thing in that it's
you have some skin in the game.
Exactly. And people are going to think through things and curate them a little better before they just throw them out there. Then at some point it dropped to, I think, $10, and now it's free, which makes it in a way more interesting from a research standpoint, because it just creates all this extra chaff that's in there. People just throwing in all kinds of crazy ideas that the system and the community has to sort through.
Right.
But it seems awfully inefficient. I think they're feeling some pains from that.
Interesting. And for the everyday innovators listening also, if you're curious about this model and more about open innovation and crowdsourced innovation, if you go back to interview 6, I also talked to a professor now, Carla Flippo, who did her dissertation also using Quirky. And Charlie, if you want to connect and collaborate, I'll be glad to make that happen later too.
Yeah, great.
So really interesting. I'll be curious to see what your findings there. Anything that can help a management team have a better, more efficient and effective decision-making process that leads to picking winners from a group of ideas, that would be really powerful, powerful insights. So we'll have to keep in touch and see where that goes. Mm-hmm. And along with that, so, you know, this is a problem a lot of companies have that are developing products, figuring out what are those winners. I'm wondering if you have seen, you know, is there another common problem you've encountered with companies when it comes to product innovation? And, you know, is there that elephant in the room that we know we should be talking about that, you know, is really limiting what could happen?
That's a great question. You know, and I think this is, looking at it from a bit of a distance, you know, I'm not a day-to-day innovator. I'm not a day-to-day product developer, but in a way that gives me some objectivity, I think,
right,
which is a good thing. I think there's this tension between the idea of, you know, radical or breakthrough innovation and real, you know, incremental or steady kind of improvement innovation. You know, if you look at the literature and the books and things that are out there and being written, you know, radical innovation, as we call it, is sexy and it's exciting, and that's what we like to think about. When you look at studies of what's done, you know, kind of categorizing the innovation that really comes out into the world, the vast majority, I mean, by different estimates, 80 to 90%, you have to categorize as much more incremental and modest innovation. Mm-hmm. So, and there are trade-offs there. You know, there's another study that I'm working on that kind of looks at the high risk, you know, high cost, high return of radical innovation versus the more predictable, modest results of incremental, and how do you balance that portfolio? And so I think, you know, broadly speaking, that's probably the biggest challenge I think companies face is, you know, they want to do the radical things. They want to invent the next product categories and platforms, but it's expensive to do that, and the cost of failure is high if it doesn't work out. So I think probably, you know, you said, what do I see companies doing wrong? I would say probably erring to the conservative side, you know, being risk averse is something that, you know, it's easy to say to companies, you need to embrace failure and accept risk and things like that. But when you're a manager who has to make numbers and whose job is on the line, it's hard to do that stuff a lot of times. And so I see a lot of great ideas that are kind of radical in the early development stages that get, you know, toned down and even kind of dumbed down sometimes to make them in the end, you know, much more modest kind of improvements over what's out there now. And so, you know, I'm not sure what the answers are, but I think just that idea of trying to find that right balance between, you know, the breakthrough stuff, which you really want to do, and the meat and potatoes sort of incremental improvements is where most companies really struggle.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And there's a tension in there, coupled with the tension of needing to keep the lights turned on and the operation running that the business is involved in.
Absolutely.
So I've asked you about a few contexts, you know, right? The research you've been involved with, maybe some insights from companies that could come out. I want to ask you about the student context too, since you teach regularly. As you're teaching students about, you know, product design, development issues, those topics, are there times that you encounter like these light bulb moments with students where they start connecting the pieces together and they go, oh, now I get it, right? Because I know in my personal experience, when I teach innovation management at the graduate level to students, many times I have students that come into the classes that have no familiarity with even the notion of what product development is, right? This idea of creating something new. And I'm curious from your experiences, have there been these light bulb moments that you kind of you see happen with your students?
Yeah. And that's what makes teaching, you know, exciting and fun. You know, the focus that I take, the structure for the course that I teach is very much around the customer journey. You know, it's a very consumer focused kind of perspective on things. And so, you know, a couple of points in there where I see light bulbs going off, you know, the very first assignment I do on pretty much the first day is, what I call a bad products assignment, which is really fun to do. And so rather than say, you know, we're going to develop a new product, let's think about some wild, you know, jetpack thing that doesn't exist yet. I really want them to sort of be grounded in the idea that there's tons of room for improvement in everyday stuff we already have around us and have had for years. So that assignment I do on the first day is kind of funny because I literally tell them to take their backpacks. And, you know, college kids these days have huge backpacks that have amazing amounts of stuff in them. And I have them dump them out on the desk in front of themselves. And then they work in little groups, twos and threes. Mm-hmm. And then I have them go through an exercise where I really want them to focus on every single little thing in that bag and think about what value that adds to their life, you know, what purpose it has, and then really focus on how well that thing performs, you know, the function it's intended for. You know, and so they might have a little stapler in there. Then, you know, eventually they'll comment that they like having a stapler because they need it, but this crummy little stapler can't do more than 5 pages at a time. And, you know, otherwise it gets gunked up. And so we'll start talking about that. And so it's a very simplistic way to look at things, but it's a really good way to get them. I really want them to critique the everyday items that they've had around them for a long, long time. So like OXO, OXO is an interesting company that's done that basically with all kinds of kitchen gadgets and appliances. And so that's the mindset that I like them to go through there. Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect of it. I think another aspect in terms of light bulb moments is when they get other perspectives on ideas. And so, you know, my students, college students, tend to be very biased towards how a college student looks at the world. I put them through a process where they're doing stuff out in the field, you know, out in the world, they're doing kind of video journals and ethnographic things. And I intentionally make them talk to other demographics than themselves. So older people, younger people, people from other countries, this and that. And I find that in developing that kind of empathy that they get from doing that really helps them be much better, you know, innovators and designers and to kind of get outside their own box quite a bit. And so they'll come back from that with lots of interesting ideas that they never would have, you know, come up with just brainstorming amongst the other college students in the room. And so I think that's worthwhile.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that customer journey focus that, you know, this is the design thinking notion of getting out of your room, out of your office and out where the users, the potential users actually are, and learning mm-hmm. from them and having those interactions. And I think so much of product innovation really comes down to the mindset of just being aware to look and make those observations about, you know, why isn't this working as well as it could? Could we make this better? You know, why hasn't anyone solved this sort of problem before? And just start thinking through those kind of issues and questions.
Yeah,
that absolutely. Sounds like a great exercise you do with your students. Thanks for sharing that.
Thank you.
I think that could be turned into a half day easy workshop for anyone listening inside a group right now to do the same sort of thing, right? Have the people show up and, you know, open up their purses and their bags and whatever they have with them. And, you know, let's start thinking about what it means to be innovative in the sense of making something better for mm-hmm. customers that provides more value. Good.
Yeah.
Thanks for talking through that with me. So I want to transition to the second part of the discussion I talked about, which was your involvement with PDMA. And I'll give you my backstory real quick on that, which is I was originally in electrical engineering, got involved in developing products and leading product development, and frankly did not even figure out what that was, right? I thought I was managing projects and we were making software systems for customers, but never thought about it in terms of product development, and knew that I needed to learn more about what we were doing. I just didn't have my hands around this full knowledge of what we were actually doing. I was thinking of still as project management. I knew I was missing some pieces, but I didn't know what they were. And I went out and looked, and I found on the web this thing called Product Development and Management Association, PDMA, and got involved with them, started helping the local chapter, got curious about what their certification was, which was the new product development professional, did that certification, created a study group to help others with it, just because I found a lot of personal value in it. And now I hear from other people that have been in those study groups that how much value they found in that too. So that's my story about, you know, my discovery of PDMA. And again, why I'm sincerely excited to be talking with you now as the current chairman of the board, to just share about, you know, what this association is. So what's your backstory? How did you come about to being involved with PDMA?
Okay, terrific. Well, PDMA is a little bit unusual as professional organizations go, in that there are some significantly different groups within the organization, at least in terms of background. You know, there's a big practitioner component and service provider component, and that is probably about 90% of the organization, 85 to 90%. And then about 10% is academics like myself. Interestingly, PDMA was actually founded by academics 30 plus years ago. So it's had a really interesting history, and I like that. I was always attracted to the organization really because of the corporate membership. You know, there are a lot of great academics involved, and it's wonderful to get to interact with them and present research to them and so on. But to me, the big appeal was always the chance to get to interact with practitioners and find out what those burning questions are, you know, that are bothering people, and maybe find some research collaborations, and you know, they're mutually beneficial. And so that's was kind of my selfish motivation, I guess, initially to get involved. And I really enjoyed kind of interacting with all these folks and what I got out of it. So that was great. So at some point in time, I was asked to become part of leadership. I worked with international affiliates and trying to build our international base, which was interesting and pretty rewarding. And then I moved into the vice president of academics role, which is in charge of a lot of our publications and our academic conferences and managing our academic membership. So that was a really good taste of what PDMA was all about and got me into a lot of things. About a year and a half ago, I was asked to be the vice chair of the organization, which, you know, was a great honor. And then in January, I became the chair. And I believe I'm the first academic to be chair in 20 or 25 years. So that's, you know, that's exciting and great opportunity to be able to do that. And so I look at the job as kind of building, you know, all the different initiatives that PDMA has going on. And, you know, we may talk about that in a minute, but also in terms of really even more tightly tying together these different constituencies that we have in the organization. And so we've done some neat things to bring together academics and practitioners, because it really can be a win-win and mutually beneficial. I mean, you know, a lot of times practitioners end up getting great consulting projects that they would otherwise pay, you know, tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollars for, really for free, you know, if they connect with the right academic and so on. And so we're trying to build those connections because that really creates value for both sets of members. And really, you know, that connection is again, what really differentiates us from other competing organizations, which are out there. So that makes it just an exciting environment to be in.
Very good. I personally like that distribution, right? The practitioner and the educational audiences and having the different people involved with the heavy focus on the practitioner. And I know in my involvement with the local chapter with PDMA, there's always been this discussion, you know, that we need practitioners because that's who actually knows what's going on in innovation. They're getting the things actually done. And I think I appreciate this more now that I've gone through the path myself of earning the PhD and doing some teaching also. That so much of what is actually in practice does come out of the academic world. It's that research opportunity that you just mentioned, which probably piqued some of our listeners' ears, like, oh, I could get free consulting if I engage in a research project with an academic. Huh, maybe that's really interesting. But it's out of those experiences that so much of what we learn informs practice and makes its way back into practice. And that's really important to have that broader range of research. Because as practitioners, we might know what works in one specific situation, and then we go try it somewhere else, and it doesn't work anymore, and we scratch our heads trying to figure out why. And it's sometimes that research that looks at the broader context that helps us understand what else we need to consider.
I think that's great. And I think, you know, conversely, just once in a while, you know, academics can get out on some esoteric limb with some thoughts.
No, that never happens.
So I think having conversations with you know, practitioners who are there in the trenches can be a fantastic reality check a lot of times and help, you know, help academics focus what they're doing more appropriately in terms of what's going on in the world. So, yeah, I think there's a symbiosis there that's wonderful. And so the more ways that we can cultivate that as an organization, you know, everybody wins. And absolutely. So that's what we're shooting for.
Which does bring up some of the, I guess, the benefits of PDMA and some of the artifacts, some of the materials they produce. I have talked to CEOs who will say, you know, I've never read anything in an academic journal that was applicable to what I do. There is that bridge. I think that's something that we in academia suffer from, of making those connections to make the materials more accessible to practitioners. And I have noticed PDMA, they address this by having two different publications, right? Supporter of the Journal of Innovation Management and also Visions. So one is more of an academic-oriented publication, and Visions is more of a industry trade, you know, practitioner publication. So those are two publications available to PDMA members. I don't know if you have any other perspective that you want to share with that also.
Yeah, well thank you for talking about those a little bit. So, you know, as you said, you know, the Journal of Product Innovation Management, or JPIM, is really the leading academic journal in new product development and innovation. So it's, you know, widely respected in the academic world, which is really important, critical to the academic side of what we do. You know, the problem with an academic journal, and, you know, I've published a fair number of things in those, is that, you know, for something to be accepted as a rigorously done thing in academics, it has to be 20 pages long and filled with a fair amount of Greek letters and formulas and things like that, just to pass muster through that rigorous, you know, review process that we go through. So, you know, as you've experienced, I've met a lot of practitioners who said, you know, if you could take that 20-page thing and give me, you know, two or three or even one nugget, you know, out of that I can take away and use that's really well-grounded, you know, that would be awesome. But I don't have time to pick through this you know, big scary article. And so we try to address that. You know, you mentioned Visions, which is more of a magazine format that comes out. And that has, you know, a lot of thought pieces and what's going on in the world sort of things and, you know, typical content like that. But we've actually added a new section to Visions in the last couple of issues that takes selected articles from the academic journal, from JPIM, and does a distilled kind of half page, very managerial, very application oriented write-up. that you know can either just be enough in itself for people to take away, or it can stimulate them to go ahead and find the full article and kind of pick through that. But I think that's really important. That's something that I pushed pretty hard for. Again, it's a way just to bridge that divide and make things accessible in a way that makes sense for practitioners. So I'm hoping we can do even more of that and you know, again, kind of build those synergies across the organization.
And what are some of the other benefits of PDMA to those listening? What are the things that would draw someone to PDMA, assuming already we're interested in product management and we want to learn more?
Sure. Good. All the research that we've done, we do tons of research on customers, you know, members and potential members, in terms of what they're looking for, it always distills down to two things. Really, which is what I call learning and connecting. So the connecting piece is, you know, networking, right? And so I think sometimes professional organizations almost undervalue how powerful that is as a driver of participation. But, you know, in product development, people want to network. They want to network to get new ideas, to learn about best practices, to learning and networking kind of blend, but also to make connections when they're looking for that next job and things like that. And so, on the connecting side, we've got our big national or international conference, which is called the PIM, or Product Innovation Management Conference. If I can put in a plug, this year it's at Disneyland in Anaheim, California, November 7th to 11th. And we get people from all over the world who come to that. I know you've come to that, Chad, mm-hmm. several times. So we appreciate that. We're also developing more regional conferences too. A lot of people are having a harder and harder time getting away from the office for 2 or 3 or 4 days and the expense associated with that. And so we're sort of building up these regional conferences to let people do one day experiences that are sort of quicker and easier and help them network locally better. We also have, as of today, I think 17 chapters around the United States, and we have 20 affiliates around the world. So we have lots of ways that people can get together and network and connect. In terms of the learning piece, right, that comes from our publications that we already talked about. That's really important. We have other things like we have awards where we identify best practice and leading practice kinds of companies. One we call the Outstanding Corporate Innovator Award, which is very prestigious. And we've had big companies like Clorox and Starbucks and so on win that in recent years. And also, you know, smaller and lesser known companies that are doing really innovative things. And particularly at our big conference, we'll have them present and share their ideas and what they're doing. And that's always a real highlight there. We have certification program, NPDP, which is the New Product Development Professional. And I know that, you know, you've been very involved in that, Chad. And that's a great way for someone, especially at the earlier stages in their career, to get a terrific, you know, concentrated jumpstart on their own knowledge base in new product development. And we're doing several things to try to grow that program and get more and more people certified. And that's moving along nicely there. Oh, gosh, we have so many things. We have a new educational platform, which is a series of on-site delivered course modules that we're offering to our corporate members. So if there are companies out there that are interested in, say, taking a whole product development team, you know, up to a higher level of expertise, we have a whole series of things that we can now offer, you know, on-site that are going to help them get there. And that's been a really exciting thing to develop, and that's rolling out, you know, as we speak. So we also have something called CPAS, which is our Competitive Performance Assessment Survey. So one of the things that we found in terms of learning is that members and potential members are really curious about what the competition is doing. No surprise there. So this idea of benchmarking, understanding best practices, things like that. And so PDMA has a long history now, probably, I think, 15 years at least, of every few years performing this very large scale study of new product development practices across a wide range of industries. And so we'll look at those long term to see how the focus in the field is shifting. And we'll also look at, you know, what the best companies are doing versus the not so best, and tease out some learning points there. And so PDMA members, you know, who attend the conferences and who get our publications can tap into all that knowledge as well. So I think we really do offer a lot of value for members, and we're encouraging and excited to have new people joining all the time.
Sure. And I like those overarching categories of learning and connecting. Lots of opportunities for learning. Another one, I don't know if this actually falls under the association. I just know it by name, right? The PDMA Toolbook Series. I know that the series of books that gets done every few years, I contributed to one of them before. The chapters are, you know, different topics, each chapter written by different individuals, really meaty, often step-by-step guidance on how you do something, right? You want to know how to do ethnography? Yeah. Well, you can go and find a chapter that will give you insights, right?
That's great. Yeah. And I was actually one of the co-editors of the most recent book, which is on open innovation. So that's, those have been really popular and successful. And so you can find all that stuff on our website.
Yep. And so for anyone that wants to get more involved with PDMA to benefit from connecting with others and learning about product management through the experience of others and also access to what has been learned by the association, where do they go to find out more about PDMA and look into local opportunities?
Terrific. Well, the general website is www.pdma.org, and you can find all kinds of resources there and, of course, information on joining and so on. And if anyone would like to contact me directly, that would be great, and I'd be happy to point you in the right direction if need be. You can reach me at chair, C-H-A-I-R, at pdma.org. That's probably the best way. And yeah, we're happy. You know, we're always looking for volunteers. We're a volunteer-driven organization. You know, I'm a volunteer. Lots of folks contribute in different ways. And so if people are interested in connecting with a local chapter or an international affiliate, or if they would maybe like to get involved in a committee and help lead our next conference and things like that, be happy to plug them into the right connections for that.
Absolutely. And does that extend also if someone's looking around for a local chapter and they don't find one, can they reach out to you to look into what's involved in getting one developed and make an offering for people to come talk about product management together?
Absolutely. Yeah. We're always looking to cultivate new chapters and, you know, a few that are in that startup stage. And so sure, if you look at the website and don't see anything too local, feel free to reach out to me. And what we'll do a lot of times is we'll study our own database and see, you know, where the concentrations of members are that aren't well served by a local chapter and do some things to try to pull them together and make some connections. So that would be great.
Okay. And again, the contact is chair, since you're chair of the board, chair@pdma.org.
Correct.
So the volunteer position comes with a nifty email address. That's nice.
That's the main perk.
That's it. So as listeners know, I like to wrap up our time together with a innovation or success quote. And so what did you choose and what was the motivation for choosing that one?
Okay, terrific. Well, obviously there are lots of wonderful quotes and, you know, you can go for the more recent things or, you know, things going back to Aristotle and so on. But, you know, one that I liked and it's really straightforward. It's by a consultant type and thinker, more importantly, who I respect a lot, Gary Hamel. And his quote is, "Innovation is enormously important. It's the only insurance against irrelevance. It's the only guarantee of long-term customer loyalty. It's the only strategy for outperforming a dismal economy." And, you know, I just think that's a fantastic quote, captures a lot of things. The idea of insuring against irrelevance really just drives home that idea that, you know, you can't stop innovating, right? And if you do, you're going to be sliding every day. You're not moving forward. And, you know, we know that, but I think that reinforces that really nicely. I think the idea of long-term customer loyalty is an interesting dimension of that. That's not always, I think, thought of when we think of innovation. I think, you know, erroneously, I think a lot of times when we think of innovation, we think of new customers. I want to create new products, exciting, pull in new customers. And that's wonderful. But I think, you know, as customers get more demanding in more and more fields, you have to dazzle them regularly, you know, and innovate for them just to keep their loyalty and keep them happy. And so I like how Hamel kind of drives that home. And then, you know, the last part was the only strategy for outperforming a dismal economy. And that is that, you know, mantra that a product developer developer has during a down economy, which is, you know, don't cut the R&D budget, don't cut the development budget when times are bad. If anything, let's do more, because that's the way to power through that. And, you know, great products and great services, people always find the resources, you know, to acquire those if you're really standing out from the crowd. So I think that quote captures a lot of nice elements there in a pretty concise way.
All really important elements. And Hamill's come up before on this podcast. He's just a great management guru and an innovation thought leader. Thanks for sharing that quote for us and those three important points there too. Is there, just in terms of the everyday innovators listening, to follow the research that you're doing, aside from the email you shared, is there another way that you want to provide listeners to just follow the work that you're doing?
You can find me on LinkedIn. Charles Noble. I'm at the University of Tennessee. I think that came up earlier. And you can catch me there. You can also catch me on Twitter, where I am not as active as I would sometimes like to be, but I try to pick my spots well. So I won't clutter up your Twitter box, so that's a good thing. But you can catch me there at Prof Noble, P-R-O-F-N-O-B-L-E, at Twitter. And I'd be happy to have you jump on. And I'd like to follow lots of other interesting people too. So I'd love to make some connections there.
Very good. Thanks so much. Again, I appreciate your time. Everyday innovators listening, thank you. Once again, we bring you these podcasts. I spend time trying to find guests that have good information to help you learn more about product development, management, and innovation, and help you stand out in the work that you're doing. If you have any suggestions for guests or how to make this time with you better, please let me know. The best way to reach me is theeverydayinnovator.com. That will forward it to my business page, and you can contact me there. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training Your Customers Will Love You For. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.